Welcome to the first ever episode of the Mac Chat Podcast, the show that uncovers the truth about misunderstood topics. I'm your host, Michaela, but you can call me Mac. On today's episode, we will be talking about performing arts schools and programs. So you may be wondering why my first episode is about the performing arts. Well, I grew up loving the arts, whether it was singing, dancing, acting, pretty much anything like that. I wanted to be a part of it. I have been in performing arts my whole life, from choir to band and even musicals. I even went to a performing arts high school. It took my parents some convincing due to the fact it was in a public school that didn't have the best reputation, but I am happy that I had the opportunity to attend that school. I remember stepping into the auditorium of the school and just falling in love. It was huge and I could picture myself performing on the stage. Not to mention, the classrooms were so spacious. Unfortunately, some of the things that I initially fell in love with were cut or owned by the public school, so we couldn't really use them. That's the issue with being in a school that's inside of another school. Yes, you guys share the same building, but some things belong to one school and some things belong to the other. So when it comes to actually using those things, it gets a little harder when you're not the one who owns it. Nonetheless, I made sure to make the most out of my experience. In the last winter showcase that I took part in that school, I grew emotional. Aww. Watching dance majors perform, singing with the choir majors, and even filling in during the musical theater piece really meant a lot to me. It was all so beautiful, and I was just so proud of everything we all accomplished. Those memories will last in a lifetime. Now, let's talk about why studying performing arts, or even just partaking in them, are beneficial. When you study the performing arts, you're not just owning your craft, you're also developing skills that are crucial in almost any other field. Take communication, for instance. Actors, dancers, and musicians are constantly learning how to express themselves clearly, how to work as part of an ensemble, and how to interpret complex ideas and emotions. These are skills that translate into leadership, teamwork, and problem solving in the real world. In an article called How the Performing Arts Benefit Mental Health by Reset Brain and Body, they talk about how creativity increases happiness, the arts increase real-life interactions, they build confidence, and they are a safe space to share emotions. All of these things can benefit literally anyone, not just people wanting to have a career in the performing arts or just even do it as a hobby. Now, on a more negative side of things, we're going to be talking about defunding. Unfortunately, in recent years, performing arts programs have been taking a hit. Budgets are shrinking, and many schools, both public and private, are cutting back on the arts. It's heartbreaking because these programs aren't just extras or nice-to-haves. They're essential to the development of well-rounded, thoughtful individuals.
I mean, obviously, they create those type of people. Don't you hear me?
I worry, personally, for my old high school because my graduating class was only 24 students. A smaller school based on the performing arts is just a recipe for defunding.
I'm especially worried because when I hear from people who still go to that high school, they mention how teachers are leaving, teachers are getting cut, and they're just worried for the future of the school. I know from when I was there, we had to make a commercial, try to get more students to enroll so that we could have better funding and so that the school wouldn't get shut down. They also were worried about attendance to make sure the school that did not get shut down.
Schools get defunded everywhere. In this one article by Alec McGillies called The Closing of School 10, Failing Enrollment After the Pandemic, they talk about a school in New York getting closed and how it affected the students. The story was absolutely heartbreaking, and I wouldn't wish that upon anyone. Students need their community. This community is mainly based in schools because that's where they spend most of their time. Not only does it hurt the students, but it also hurts the teachers. Just imagine, you took all this time to get a degree, and it's just getting harder and harder to put it to good use. Because of this fear, there is less and less teachers for the arts, and so many more open spots. In an article called Why the Arts Matter by Tanisha Pruitt, they spoke to an Ohio Art Education Association president and visual arts teacher at Pickerington High School Central named Matt Young. He said that his district is very fortunate to have enough resources to provide a quality arts education for their students, but lacks enough art teachers. He continued by mentioning they have to turn students away from art programs because they do not have enough staff to support them. All right, now it's time to get to debunking. Let's talk about the difference from television. When you hear about the performing arts, you may think of High School Musical or that TV show called Victorious back on Nickelodeon, but I'm here to tell you it is nothing like that. No, get that out of here. Performing arts schools aren't just places where students get to learn to sing or dance or act, though that's obviously a huge part of it. These schools are like a training ground for creativity, discipline, and collaboration, not to mention your average education too. Victorious made it look like every day was a musical number, where everyone's life was a mix of singing, dancing, and drama. Which, yes, there's a lot of drama, but the truth is, performing arts schools require an immense amount of discipline. You're often spending hours in rehearsals, practicing your craft and perfecting it, and getting feedback and pushing through challenges. It's not always glamorous. There's this myth that performing arts schools are just places where everyone gets to show off their talents in a perfect, effortless way. Well, the reality is, it's a lot of hard work. You need to be prepared for rejection, constant improvement, and sometimes even personal struggle. On top of that, you have to worry about your other studies to make sure you're doing well in all aspects of school. There could be times where you're staying late for a rehearsal and have an exam the next day. It sounds stressful, but it's definitely all worth it. Well, it looks like that's all for today. Don't forget to tune in next time to hear the truth about a new misunderstood topic. Thanks for listening. Love ya and goodbye.
Bye. Have a great time.
Hey guys, welcome to today's episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Eric Trevoni, and we will be taking a variety of approaches to look at what music is. Now, let's consider some of our own experiences with music. Why is it that certain songs move us and others don't? David Huron, an empirical musicologist and professor at The Ohio State University in both the School of Music and the Center of Cognitive and Brain Sciences, has done some interesting work on the topic. His research suggests that it's all about expectation. Thus, he developed a theory and framework on the psychological processes involved in expectation. His ITPRE framework examines the psychophysiological processes and how we experience music. There are studies that show that large regions of the brain are used for prediction, but brains don't just predict and forecast. They affect how we feel, and therefore our emotions. When a person expects some event to occur, the timely occurrence of that event causes them to experience pleasure. Research cited by Huron shows that this is true, and therefore there's a pleasure principle that drives our predictions. So our brains are constantly trying to predict what will happen, and this is why we get pleasure from listening to music, which plays with these expectations. Huron's ITPRE model considers five expectation-related response systems: the imagination, tension, prediction, reaction, and appraisal. The imagination, tension, and prediction responses are future-directed and occur in decreasing timescales. This means that imagination occurs farthest in advance, then tension builds as the event approaches, and prediction happens just before the event takes place. The response and appraisal are then post-event responses. The reaction is the immediate reflexive response, occurring automatically without thinking. Appraisal is the more thoughtful and conscious response that occurs after the reaction. I think that most people can relate these principles back to how they themselves experience music, thus proving the framework to be quite effective. Personally, it reminds me of my first time listening to jazz music. At first, I disliked it, but looking back, it's because it really challenged my brain's predictions. Oftentimes, it seemed to be deliberately trying to undermine our expectations, but slowly, I've grown accustomed and began to enjoy listening to it. But this leads to an important question. Do we inherently like specific types of music? or is it culturally acquired from the shaping of our prediction pleasure response? Well, a fascinating aspect of music is how it's written into our biology. Let's start with rhythm. According to the article, Self-Generated Sounds of Locomotion and Ventilation and the Evolution of Human Rhythmic Ability by Mats Larson, there is data noise in locomotion and ventilation, which means that movement and breathing contains critical auditory information. People subconsciously synchronize footsteps, and this sense of rhythm helps the brain distinguish discrete sounds and synchronize movements. This gives spaces of silence to listen to the environment and to filter unimportant similar sounds. Harmony is, of course, another component of music. When we hear a sound, hairs along the cochlea in our ears respond to varying sound frequencies. Each hair cell connects to a neuron, which sends a signal to the brain that has heard that frequency. So when we are listening to music and hear a chord with, let's say, two notes, then two hair cells are triggered, and each sends a signal to the sensory neuron. These sensory neurons then send a signal to an internal neuron, which sends a signal to the brain. As shown by a number of researchers in the article titled Spike Train Statistics for Consonant and Dissonant Musical Chords in a Simple Auditory Sensory Model, these neurons can be expressed as a system of differential equations and probability distributions to predict neurons' firing times. If you're solving for the interneurons' firing times, you can look at the probability distribution for different chord ratios, and you will find that simple ratios have much more regular and predictable signals. And yeah, that's why we enjoy simple chords, but again, you will notice that jazz makes successful use of dissonances and a lack of predictability. And we recognize that some chords have an emotion associated with them. I think many of us have probably heard before that major chords are happy and minor chords are sad. It's clear that our brains are wired to sort of appreciate certain harmonies and dissonances, but it makes you wonder whether our tastes are biological predispositions or something culturally acquired and personal. Well, research by David Huron, drawing on Charles Sander Peirce's work in semiotics, suggests that our responses to music are deeply rooted in our evolutionary history. When you hear high or low frequencies, you are engaging in something called sound size symbolism. This is because low sounds typically signal something large and potentially threatening, while higher pitches suggest something smaller and less threatening. And this is directly connected to our facial expressions and behaviors. When we smile, our vocal cavity becomes smaller, raising the pitch of sounds produced. When we do the opposite of smiling, pouting, our vocal cavity gets larger, producing lower and more threatening sounds. These are universally recognized as prosocial and antisocial, but it doesn't stop there. Volume, cadence, pitch, and timbre are all connected to specific emotional states, not something we learn by association. So our ability to create and understand music isn't just cultural, it's part of our evolutionary heritage. So then, if music is so deeply rooted in our biology, then why do we have so much variation in musical taste? I think that Antonio Soriano, the author of a musical blog, has a great theory for this. He believes there are three fundamental ways of listening to music: syncopation, linear melody, and chordal harmony, or more commonly known as rhythm, melody, and harmony. But good music isn't about maximizing the complexity of these three. Usually the most compelling music has a primary element and uses the other two in a more supporting role. An example of this is James Brown, a famous blues musician who typically uses rhythm to carry and melody and harmony as support. On the other hand, Beethoven's symphonies primarily use harmony and melody, with rhythm taking the supporting role. The theory is that people tune into these different channels of listening more strongly than others, in some way, probably because of the previously discussed predictive ability of our brains, which we know is malleable. So by taking some time to develop an ear for differently element-focused styles of music, we can appreciate the more complex pieces that other styles have to offer. I also think that this helps explain why musical tastes have shifted throughout history, from the complex melodies of the Baroque period to the harmonic and rhythmic emphasis in Romance period and jazz music. And speaking of taste, music plays a major role in advertising. Huron also discusses its role in his paper, Music and Advertising: The Analytic Paradigm. In it, he identifies six basic ways that music can contribute to advertisement. Introduced in approximately historical order, the first is entertainment, which means to engage attention or draw interest, kind of self-explanatory. Next is structure or continuity, which is where music ties together some continuous sequences, such as visual images or edits. This can also be a means of emphasis, such as the kind we see during dramatic moments in films. Next is memorability, which is due to consumers being known to favorite products which they have some degree of familiarity with. For example, classic jingles can follow us our whole lives, even unwillingly. Then comes lyrical language, which is another technique where singing is used to relegate emotional messages. Oftentimes, these would sound banal or cliche when spoken, but when conveyed lyrically, have an emotional and poetic appeal. These are often favored over logical appeals because competing products usually have weak, real, and factual merits. Then there's targeting, which is where demographics are targeted through musical styles long associated with them. One way this functions is as a socioeconomic identifier, but it can also be regional. Finally, there's authority establishment, which is where music is used to enhance the ad's credibility. Essentially, here advertisers tap into societal values like patriotism, friendship, humor, and nostalgia. But hearing tunes again doesn't just satisfy our event-predicting brains. It takes us back to our childhood and lets us reminisce on and revisit memories that may have been forgotten up until that point. Notice how nostalgia also plays an important role here. It's really baked into how we experience music, since otherwise, a bit pessimistically, advertisers wouldn't be trying to use it to boost sales. So my point here is that art clearly helps drive consumer behavior, which makes clear that it can affect our behavior in very unexpected ways. This brings us to probably the most profound shift in how we experience music, and that is due to the impact of technology. In his famous essay, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, Walter Benjamin argues that historically, art derived its value and authenticity in its role in ritual and religious traditions, not from being hung in a museum. For most of human history, music was inseparable from ceremony and community gatherings that occurred in specific moments. Benjamin also observed that photography and film change our relationship with the visual arts, but the invention of digital and recording technologies has also changed our relationship with music too. For instance, there's a new phenomenon where living musicians are forced to compete with dead ones for attention and finances. Here we have moved from what Benjamin calls ritual value to exhibition value. In the past, if you wanted to listen to music, you had to physically be there, be it during a church mass, a community celebration, or a concert hall. It was tied to a place, a community, and had a spontaneity to it. Benjamin says that it had an aura, which is basically a unique presence in time and space. Nowadays, you can virtually access every recorded piece of music from your phone, heard the exact same way each and every time. This has caused music to lose its spontaneity and sense of communal experience for many people. Lydia Gert, a professor of philosophy at the University of Columbia in New York, argues in her book, Imaginary Museum of Musical Works, that our notion of a musical work is a relatively recent development. Prior to the 1800s, music was primarily about improvisation, but think about it nowadays, where most music is played precisely as written or produced to be heard the same way each time. I think that classical music has adopted this approach, where musicians are focused on technical perfection. Improvisation does play a big role in jazz performances, but the paradox is that when recorded, even an improvised piece can become standardized. This new standard and relationship with music is not at all representative of how composers from the past, whose works are now housed in this imaginary museum, viewed or practiced music themselves. I think that the main idea is that societal concepts shape and sometimes constrain the way we practice music itself. And now, with the advent of ever-improving artificial intelligence and generative music, we are confronted with the question, what is the difference between noise and music? Maybe in this day and age, the real value of music will go full circle back to valuing ritual experience and improvisation so that music can return to the living. And yeah, that brings us to the end of today's podcast. Thank you for joining me on this exploration of music's origins and history. If you enjoyed the discussion, share it with others who may find it interesting, and be sure to tune into the other podcast episodes. Till next time.